Good evening and welcome to CounterPulse. My name is Jessica Robinson Love. I'm the executive and artistic director here, and I'm so glad that you all have joined us for Dance Discourse Project number 10, Are We Trapped in a Static Presenting Model? So I think we all are excited to get to the conversation, but before we do, just a little bit of background. The Dance Discourse Project is an initiative that was created by Mary Armantrout. She signed me on to be her co-conspirator, and it's basically an attempt that we've been making for the last several years to get beyond I liked it, I didn't like it, and have some meaningful conversation about what we're doing as practitioners in the dance community in the Bay Area. So we've talked about a lot of different topics, from what makes Bay Area dance unique to site-specific work, to dancing in a post-multiculturalism landscape, to dance and YouTube and multimedia. They've been great conversations, and you can actually listen to all of them on the CounterPulse website and the Dancers Group website. If you know people who missed tonight's conversation, they can listen to this as well. So it's a program co-produced by Dancers Group and CounterPulse. And having said that, I will turn it over to my co-conspirator, Mary Armantrout.
Thank you. And let's see, I just want to jump in and give you guys all a little more bearing for this Dance Discourse project number 10, so you have some thoughts to have in your head as you listen to this kind of amazing array of panelists that we have somehow managed to corral for you today. So I just want to give you a little bit of introduction or a way to start your thoughts flowing. So the title of this DDP is, Are We Trapped in a Static Presenting Model? Sounds kind of heavy to me already. And as you may have gleaned from the short description of this event that we've been kind of sending around, this DDP is training its lens on this habit that we have of presenting our dance works at 8 p.m. on weekend evenings and asking if this is a good idea, the best idea, or perhaps just one of many ideas for how dance could be presented. And so we really kind of want to take a look at, you know, why is it that we do it this way? How else could we be doing it? Why might we want to change? Those are some of the questions on the dock for tonight. As the blurb says, much of contemporary dance in the Bay Area continues to be presented Thursday through Saturday at 8 p.m. in traditional venues, following the patterns of many other performance art forms. Distance is often created between serious contemporary forms and popular forms. And the underlying assumption is that to be considered legitimate, whatever that word might mean, a work must have certain presentational aspects, be associated with certain venues, and subscribe to particular codes of relating to the audience. However, much of the exciting work in contemporary dance of the last 10 years explodes this model and questions whether it helps or hinders the evolution of the dance form. At the same time, much of the work that doesn't fall into this proscenium stage at 8 p.m. model struggles to find its path to legitimacy, if that means funding, reviews, and/or presenters. So tonight, Jessica and I are going to talk with Wayne Hazard of Dancers Group, Joel Barakel-Tan of YBCA, or Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, Ron Reagan of the Hewlett Foundation, Vanessa Camarena Arredondo, and Micah Sigourney, which happens to be a very diverse group of artists, funders, curators, presenters, and writers, and all of them are usually more than one. So we're all together going to try and explore this question with you guys' help of, is the 8 p.m. proscenium model path to legitimacy still relevant for us now, here, and if so, why?
So we decided to have this conversation now in part because our current artists in residence at CounterPulse, Keegan Marling, who is in the back over there, and Eric Cooper's Dandelion Dance Theater are doing their best to make this not feel like a theater. So if you come to their performance in a few weeks, you will see them performing on the risers, an audience on the stage, and a sort of complete breakdown of the relationship between the audience, or the expected relationship between the audience and the performer. So that gave us some food to have this conversation this evening. And then also I just wanted to call in the fact that I see this conversation happening in a lot of different ways in the Bay Area. So, for instance, Philip Wong's Home Theater Festival, the Red Poppy Art House and the work that they're doing with Mission Performing Arts, Jorge de Hoyos and a bunch of the folks who are organizing these interventions on public transportation, the long-term site-specific work that Joanna Hygood and Joe Kreider and Kim Epifano and others have been doing, the interesting cross-pollination that's happening with the drag community and the contemporary dance community, which I feel like is happening more and more these days, and also new experiments in MP3 performance and crowdsourced art. So there's a lot going on that we can talk about. And we've gathered together a group of people who I am particularly excited about, the smart people here and the smart people there. So I'm just going to say briefly the hats that these people wear in multiple capacities. So we're going to start with Vanessa Camarena Arredondo, who's a vocalist with Las Bomberas de la Bahia, an ensemble that performs and upholds the Afro-Puerto Rican tradition of bomba. She recently completed a fellowship in the Arts and Culture program at the San Francisco Foundation. She has experience as being a funder as well. Micah Sigourney is a performance artist and curator. He has an extensive background in physical theater and now performs under the drag name Vivienne Forevermore and hosts Something, a weekly drag art dance party. And he's also performing and collaborating with Keegan Marling as an artist in residence at Counterpulse right now. Wayne Hazard is the executive director and co-founder of Dancers Group. He's had a 20-year career as a dancer for many of the Bay Area's most exciting companies and is a powerful advocate for dance. Joelle Barakiel-Tan is the Director of Community Engagement at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts and is an award-winning editor, writer, and visual artist. And Ron Reagan is a Performing Arts Program Officer at the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. He's a vocalist, composer, and poet, and is working on his first collection of poems, and I found out this evening, also just won a Grammy. So you'll have to ask him about that later. One of the things I'm most excited about, as you can see, each of our panelists is a working artist as well as their role as a presenter, a funder, or organizer. And that'll bring a richness to the conversation, I think. So just a little housekeeping before we get started. I'm going to ask, what we're going to do first is hear about 5 to 8 minutes from each panelist, including some quick video clips. Then Mary and I will sort of start a conversation, and then we'll open the conversation up to you all. So be thinking now about questions, reactions, comments, ideas, instigations that you might have for us. And when we do pass it on to that time, I just want to let you all know and remind us as a panelist that we are recording this for podcast. So please use a microphone. Did I leave anything out, Mary?
Did great.
Okay. Vanessa, would you like to start us off?
Can you hear me? Yeah. What I want to do first is show you some clips of the group that I perform with, and also show you some clips of some work, some bomba being done in Chicago, which is presented differently. So let's run the clips first, if you wouldn't mind. Thank you so much. So this first one is at a house in Chicago, where there's a large Puerto Rican community, and bomba is traditionally Puerto Rican. And so they actually have a home that's a cultural space where it's presented on weekend. Oh, we're actually going to see Bomberas first, excuse me. We're going to see just some footage of the local group that I perform with, Las Bomberas de la Bahía, doing performing at Guerrilla Cafe in the East Bay in Berkeley. And also at the Queer Women of Color Film Festival at Brava Theater. Well, there was a little bit more, but that's fine. That was just us. The second one was us performing at Brava. But let's look at this. This is fun. So this is a group called Buya, and the people that you see playing are both in the group Buya and also our community members. We have two teachers from Puerto Rico in the back. And the reason I chose to show this piece is just because essentially, that's kind of how people learn bomba, the way you see the little girl kind of participating with one of the leading dancers here in the U.S., really. Her name is Ibelis Diaz. And so that's kind of like how it starts. If you think about a stage, this is Sunday afternoon, and the players that you see, some are in performing ensembles, and others just kind of show up to perform. All right, that's good. Thank you. So what Bomberas is doing here, we're performing in the diaspora, so the music is a tradition that was started during the time of the slaves, really, and it was it's a music of resistance, and people would perform certain songs to kind of deliver messages and spread messages throughout the community. And then other times it was just to dance and have fun. And as our director said, Denise Solis, in that one clip, we weren't all there. So it's a history, it's an oral tradition that we're all kind of trying to understand. I myself aren't of Puerto Rican or Black heritage, so there is some controversy that comes to presenting that arises with us presenting work in the Bay Area, and specifically this work where there's not a large Puerto Rican community as there is in Chicago and New York. But what we do is more and more being called urban bomba. So essentially, it's performing a traditional form in an urban setting, and what is that? What does that mean to the tradition? To kind of upholding the tradition, and to also expanding kind of venues where it can be presented, and people who can perform it. Which there's a lot of controversy. There's a lot of controversy around because of issues of appropriation and people who are not Puerto Rican performing the music, and also how to learn in the diaspora is challenging. So, for example, this weekend we're bringing two teachers in from Puerto Rico to kind of like to work both with to offer public workshops, but really to work intensively with the group, because there are two teachers here in the Bay Area, but we don't perform as part of that ensemble, so there's some challenges around how we learn bomba, a lot of which is through YouTube and some through Skype, and then our visits to Puerto Rico. And that's just some background on the group. But essentially, the way that we look at creating audio, we perform in different places. We perform in parks, in backyards, a lot in homes. Bomba can just kind of like happen in a lot of different spaces. There doesn't necessarily need to be a set performance in order for it to kind of happen. So it kind of operates outside of the Thursday through Sunday 8 p.m. model. But then we also do present in those forums. But we're also kind of really alive on in the club scene, which makes it challenging to present traditional work where there's actually a history tied to it, and we will stop in the middle of songs and kind of explain the history of the work, and people are open to it for the most part, and I think that loans some heart to the form, but I think that, you know, at the end of the day, people want to be moved and they want to dance when they're in a club setting. But a lot of the way that the way our stages have been created has been what meaning we bring to people in the community. So, for example, the second clip was going to show a little bit of the Queer Women of Color Film Festival. So there's different people, different audiences, the queer community, a lot of there's a woman's kind of like a women's festival or conference that happens in Richmond, California, which is kind of isolated from a lot of performance venues, so we'll kind of show up to do performances in elementary schools and in after school and on the weekends, where there's kind of like mixed audiences, where there's like parents and grandmothers and children in the space. And so our audience can sometimes define the spaces that we perform in. And I think, you know, that I don't think that that's new. I think that that's, but it's the way that we kind of show up in community. And I think part of the tradition of bomba is because it's very small. It's small-ish, you know. It's big to us, but it's is how it regenerates itself, how students become practitioners. And because it's, as you saw, it's a participatory form of music or a tradition. So it's really important that in order for the tradition to live and to survive, that people learn, and that people. So then, how do you engage? We have to think about how we engage, you know, a novice artist or practitioner, which many of us are actually. We kind of started and learned within the group, but that's where the tension comes around. Well, if you're doing bomba in California, where there's not a large Puerto Rican community, how do you generate more bomba artists, and then, you know, well, a Mexican's going to show up at some point. And so I and so I showed up, and so did our practitioner, our one of our directors. And so to this question of legitimacy and how venues venues kind of legitimize performance. I consider bomba to be part of like a fringe folk culture, and Micah and I were kind of speaking about how, you know, I feel like, you know, drag and bomba, it's kind of like happening over here, you know, and sometimes it kind of makes it to this main stage. We just did the Ethnic Dance Festival last year, which was really great. But even that's kind of fringy, you know what I mean, to a certain degree. And it depends on like what you consider to be the mainstream, because to some people, the mainstream, it doesn't come on the map. It's not, you know, so is the ballet mainstream, or in a Latino immigrant community, the ballet isn't mainstream. Mariachi is mainstream, or, you know, so... But thinking about like traditional stages, I feel like in some ways bomba falls out of the mainstream, because our audiences, we really draw from clubs in our audiences and to build our audiences. So the bomba itself, and as a practitioner, we're really legitimized by people within the tradition mostly. And I suppose, like as a performer, there's times when it really is legitimizing to perform at the Ethnic Dance Festival, and that was or when we performed in New York at this thing called Bom Plenazo, but that was very specifically for the Bomba en Plena community. But as far as like where we feel like we're really creating strong work, one is a space like the Ethnic Dance Festival, and another is mostly it's through other bomba practitioners really feeling like the work resonates with them, and like we're really representing the tradition well, and both as musicians and, you know, just as culture bearers. So that's kind of where our legitimacy comes from, but that's not always helpful in a place like California. Thankfully, we have a lot of enlightened funders, I would say. So they see everything. And when I was a funder, I tried to see everything, you know, as a creative expression. And I think that I would want to move away from like, oh, there's traditional and then there's ballet. It's like, no. There's both in this space. And how do we honor and elevate both? But you know, the challenge of performing bomba is that sometimes people don't always understand your form. So they don't understand, well, what's quality, what's not quality, is your group legitimate because they have, so what are the markers to indicating whether it's like legitimate or not? That we have an audience, that people want to come through. Is that audience Puerto Rican? Is that audience Mexican? Are we not even concerned with the color or the ethnicity of the audience? I think, you know, sometimes, or if you think about applying to a grant, for a grant, who's on the panel and how are they going to understand your work? I mean, that's like a real issue. And again, thankfully, California has a lot of enlightened funders, so it's not always a huge concern. But I think one of the concerns that's come up for us is how we're viewed as composers. And I think that I think I'll stop there for now, but it's just, you know, so that's a conversation that we need to have with ourselves as a group, and also engage people who are funding in that realm.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. Let's go straight on to hearing from Micah.
Oh, hello. Hi, everybody.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Thanks. So I just want to give a little more of a bio so you know where I'm coming from. I throw a weekly party that's a drag show. I host the party. I have a collaborative team that I work with, and we curate about seven different performers every week for the party. And while it's a drag party, we also have live performers. We have theater artists. It kind of goes, oh no, I lost my page. It goes across the board, and that's really important to us. So that's where I'm really talking from. So there are a few things in this the opening statement, or however you want to talk about what you had read earlier that I wanted to address first so that we're all, I'm using language that we all know what I'm saying. So static model, which would be like time and location, Thursday to Sunday or Thursday to Friday around Thursday to Saturday at 8 p.m. Legitimacy, and in this conversation, I think legitimacy, unless reframed, is talking about funding, reviews, and attendance. And then that's really it. So I think I was invited to really address this last part of the statement, which was, however much of the exciting work in contemporary dance of the last 10 years explodes this model and questions whether it helps or hinders the evolution of the dance form. I'm not a dancer, so I can't talk about dancing, but I can talk about fringe performance. I think there's like a big difference between what you find in the dance world, which is professional dancers or artists who are making a living on their art, and what you find in fringe performance, which I, by that I mean specifically the nightlife, go-go dancers or drag artists or burlesquers, cabaret performers, who are not necessarily trying to find like sustenance from their art. They usually have other jobs. This is a hobby. This is not their career necessarily, or it's not allowed to be their career because they're not going to make the money that you could being a professional dancer. So that was my first thing. And what Jessica said earlier is there's this crossover happening right now between maybe the drag world or the nightlife and the dance world. And I think that's really interesting in that, I'm sorry, I'm really nervous. It's hard for me to get my thoughts together. Are you guys nervous too? Oh, it makes me feel so much better. Sorry. I guess, okay, I'm gonna go back to the opening statement again. So, we have this sentence where we are juxtaposing the terms serious and popular modes of performance, and I think that's really problematic in that I would say drag and fringe performance is popular and quite serious. Drag, I'll speak more specifically about drag being, I think of it as a folk art. So it's not this, you're not going to school for it. You're learning it from your chosen family, a lineage. There is tradition that's different based on who's teaching you. There's technique that's different based on who's teaching you, and it's not like you're not going to get a degree in it. And there's not necessarily a broad range about like the people who know what drag are the drag queens, right? Like the people who know what good bomba is are the bomba performers and makers. So it's this closed circuit here, right? So I think there's a problem between the word serious and popular, Mary. Just totally messing with you. So I can knock it down. Thank you. I like some resistance. So then we have this crossover happening, right? There's these dancers or more traditional art makers or people who that's their careers going into the nightlife and performing on, say, my stage at the Stud on Friday nights, if you're interested. And they're getting this benefit of performing there, such as they're getting recognition, they're creating new audiences for themselves, they're gaining experiences that they don't have before, they're learning how to interact with an audience in a new way, and they're leaving with this set of skills and this set of experiences, and maybe even more revenue in that they've generated more audience for themselves. And so they have this crossover that's really beneficial. They go into the nightlife, then they go back and they do their other things, right? They go in the go-go dance, they get $60, free drinks, make a lot of friends and new audience members, they give them a flyer for their show at Counterpulse, that those people come. You have drag queens, who are not versed in this institution, whatever, of performance, our static presentation model, who aren't don't have access to funding, don't know the system, and for them to leave, for example, I performed here at Counterpulse. I come to Counterpulse, I perform my drag act. I go back to the stage, my stage, and maybe I got a few more audience members, right? But I didn't like my skill set hasn't necessarily changed because I don't have this training. This path to legitimacy built into my training. Like, I still don't know how to access funding. I don't know how to write a press release still. Not that all dancers know this, but like, there's more of that happening in that world. So I'm saying the fringe performers don't gain what they're missing, like what their counterparts have. But their counterparts, these dancers, are gaining what the nightlife performers have, which is this certain experience. So I think that's a really interesting contrast. Sorry, I'm just trying to read this. There's also this idea of legitimization, or being legitimate, which is having funding. For me, I'm going to talk about funding because I want funding right now. How does a drag queen get funding? Write a grant, right? But so then, as a drag queen, I perform here at Counterpulse, right? My art form, drag queening or whatever, lip syncing, is really based on my context. Same with Bumble, like you're talking about your audience and like this, like a club atmosphere. My audience, my club, my party is as much part of my medium as my face and my makeup. So for me to write to a funder, come see my, like fund, or funders going, I don't know, I'm not a funder. Do funders go to the nightlife all the sometimes? But it's just like, it's, there's this problem, which is, and why should I have to decontextualize myself and put myself in a traditional performance venue in order to seek that funding that other more traditional, such a problematic word, more, whatever, legitimate artists have? Like, why do I have to leave where my work has the most meaning? And you can come into my context, you know, you can go to this, if you're over 21, you can go to the Stud on a Friday night and you can enter my context and have my experience with me. But why should I have to take away that context in order to get funding and critics and stuff like that? That's more of a systematic thing, I guess, right? Okay, hold on one second. Does all that make sense? Did anyone have... Okay. How's everyone doing? Okay. I just need to check in. I guess that's really my biggest thing right now, is those three things. There's also this language as a barrier to legitimization, like, so the ability to write a grant, like, how does drag queen get funding? Write a grant. Okay, I'll do that in between my nightclubbing responsibilities and my 9-to-5 job and these other things. Not that art, not that other dancers don't have this problem too, but I'm just saying, like, the people who are more trained in their art forms or who have gone to school or have training are also often given the option to learn about that or have heard that word grant. I can show you 10 drag queens and be like, do you want to write a grant? And they will say they don't know what that is, you know? And not because they're dumb, it's just their exposure and their context again. So I think that, do I think we are trapped in the static presenting model? Yeah, I do. And I don't think it's a problem either. I think it is currently a path to legitimization, but it's a selective path and not everyone has access to it. And I would say people in folk traditions often don't. People who are French performers don't. Like, one of my favorite art forms is go-go dancing. And I, like, take it really seriously. I could write you an artist statement about it if I wanted to. But I'm not going to get funding to go-go dance yet, Jessica. Just saying. So, sorry. And also, like, artists in residencies, for example. Like, I'm not going to get an artist in residency to go-go dance. Because that's, not, like, it's a context-based form. I guess that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. That gave us a lot to think about. And we'll have more time for questions once we hear from everyone. Wayne, would you like to take it from here?
Working?
Yeah.
No? Yes? Oh, okay. Great. Hi, everyone. So I have three words that I'm going to sort of riff on. My first word is selfish. So I'm selfishly interested in moving us forward in some way to other kinds of presenting times or places. So in my work with Dancers Group, we talk with artists about what is interesting to them. So for us, it's not the idea that we want to find new places or new times for artists to perform, but we want to provoke a conversation that gets the artist really excited about being at an in some way performing their work that's at another time or another place. So the selfish thing for me is then there's possibly more people to see that work because it's just not on 8 o'clock on a Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. And I don't know, like many of you, there's so many works out there that I want to see, but because with dance in particular, it's only on one weekend or even two weekends, I can't see it. Mary did a recent show that was over three weekends, two nights, and I still didn't have time in my busy schedule to see it, and luckily she's going to bring it back. So I think selfishly, I want us as a community, as people who are the artists who are practitioners, to want to be involved in this conversation. So obviously, I think that while we are, I think, stuck in this idea of there's only certain times to perform and maybe those help a sensibility of legitimacy, they're also very limiting, I think, in terms of how much money you can make. If you look at it, you know, totally on, you know, how much you invest, you've spent a year making the work and then you put it up for three nights. It's crazy. I mean, it's just totally, absolutely crazy to think that you're going to do that. I mean, I think there's thoughts that, oh, then I'm going to get to tour it or I'm going to get to do it again. But realistically, the most of the artists that Dancers Group works with aren't touring and aren't having that situation to be able to move that forward. So again, it's my selfishness to want to have conversations with artists, not that we as an organization or as a presenter want people to perform differently. If somebody really wants to perform Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 8 p.m., that's great. But I think most people coming up the ranks aren't thinking about that question. It's sort of it can be a given or a, well, that's what happens, it's easy, and there's so many other things to think about. So my second word is visibility. So that's sort of a simple thing. So you do things at different times, there's sort of a hook, there's sort of a uniqueness to doing something on the streets in a variety of ways, whether it's a flash mob sensibility or a project that we did with Joanna Hygood where she did 12 to 5 for 7 days, and the work was on a loop. So there was about 49,000 people that saw parts of this work over that 5-hour period. It was a free work, so there wasn't any money, but the value of the visibility, the value of what those performers got in terms of being in the work, immersed in it for a different kind of time and place, I think was the value of what that is in terms of that. I think especially now I see more press interested in covering things that are unusual. So I think there's can be an advantage to having your work presented at different times, at different nights around visibility, because people, you know, the visibility will create, as has already been heard, this legitimization, whether it's a review or a preview or your pictures in the paper or things like that. My third word is active. Why did I do this third word? Oh, it was sort of an active, passive kind of thing. So I think it's sort of our interest in terms of having that conversation with artists is provoke a more active sensibility about how they want their work seen in terms of that. So I think we're talking with people who are, you know, wanting a career as dance artists. So there is that active sensibility when they're thinking about, okay, I'm making a work that's about love, how do you want that work to be seen? We had a conversation earlier where part of this work we did, Love Everywhere, was at City Hall at 12 noon, and then the artist took sections of that piece out on the streets through a Saturday, performed it for people in Union Square. This one woman said, this was the greatest gift. She thought, why is this being given to me? So this active sensibility about finding audience is also really interesting us to talk with artists about that. And then it was also performed at Glide Memorial Church in terms of that active engagement. And they were the most amazing audience because they're so used to performances about being part of their church and about participating. So it was this amazing thing of getting into and swaying and dancing to the piece immediately. There was nothing about judging or looking at. So that active participation or finding those ways that we can engage and help artists find those opportunities are what's interesting to us. So I think that's it for me. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Joelle, do you want to take it away?
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Joelle Tan, Director of Community Engagement at YBCA. And I wanted to first acknowledge really the panelists and Mary and Wayne and Jessica and everybody who made this happen and usually thank, but it's amazing to be the people, the other artists and art lovers want to discuss art and want to geek out this way, and it's so neat. So thank you. So I'm going to show and tell. So maybe we can run that first video, and I'll maybe start with the story of how I came onto this panel, because I resisted it the entire time. I had this invitation as soon as I got the invitation for Dance Discourse Project and saw the topic is the presenting model static. I immediately ran to my colleague, Angela, who I've worked with for the last 6.5 years and who's been able to skillfully now manage to find a way to deal with my hysteria. So with that, she assures me, Jessica assures me, and I'm going to show you a little bit of one of the things that I do, and it's Big Idea Night. And I wonder if we could run that first video with DIYBCA. This was, this video that you're looking at was filmed last August, and it was not filmed. Is this the DIY? It was not filmed. Yeah, this is not filmed by YBCA staff, but it was actually something we found the day after a Big Idea Night. I don't know who's been to a Big Idea Night? Awesome, great. Big Idea Night is a semi-regular, somewhat quarterly event happening, art party that we throw at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, which is part open house, part art party, part showcase, and mostly user-generated, user-designed. And so this night in particular, this is DIYBCA in conjunction with our big idea, DARE, which is innovation in audiences and just innovation and interaction. In addition to that, we have this amazing first part of an exhibition around audiences, exhibition on audiences, and we had this thing. So maybe we can play it. So this is something that was generated by an attendee.
It was working during the test.
Let's go to the next one, the people. Well, the cool thing about this was that an audience member, and we didn't expect it. So these big idea nights usually bring in anywhere from 1,500 to 3,000 people into our space. And what you're looking at is a drinking and dancing competition that we brought from the lab. And that happened in the forum. And out in the lobby, we had Mrs. Vera and her crew doing a DIY drag thing where everybody brought in their leftover crap from 99-cent stores, and they all redesigned shoes, handbags, etc. In addition to that, like what you're seeing now, you're seeing the open house aspect. People are in the galleries looking at work, dealing with design, custom tailored. Oh, this is the eBay Har one, yeah. Where we were looking at crowdsourcing, we were looking at like tailored work by consumers. And so we created what I'm calling the vernacular around not only that exhibition, but the big idea itself. So the point of drinking and dancing is that you're supposed to incorporate the drinking with the dance. So there was a contest. So more than anything, I can talk about how these events are meant to really bring in different kinds of audiences to YBCA. And so we program our audiences as much as we program our artists. And I'll talk a little bit about what makes my kind of programming different from, let's say, Angela's. all right, so can we bring it to half light and then maybe have the people one playing just without the sound? I wanted to show another video, and as I talk a little bit more about YBCA, and I wanted to address this issue of are we in a static presenting model, I want to go back to, again, kind of my awkwardness, or I guess even my queerness, the initial queer feeling I had about this, because I thought, well, I'm not a presenter necessarily. I program work, I curate work, but it really got me to think about the difference between what I do and what my colleagues do, who are curators. The director of visual arts, Betty Sue Hertz, our film programmer and curator, Joel Shepard, and Angela. We started doing these big idea nights from this Wallace Foundation grant that we'd gotten. And I started these big idea nights 2 years ago. And they've been steadily successful in terms of audiences and bringing in different kinds of audiences. But in terms of how we curate, in many ways, one thing I think about is the audiences we want to bring in that I'd already mentioned in context to the work that we're already presenting. But at another level, I think when I first started this, I'd envision something like beyond that, where I just kind of looked at our grand lobby and looked at all the spaces, everything from our elevators to our bathrooms. And I just thought to myself, how can we make this look and feel more like an art center? Can we play that second one? The second video I just wanted to show in the background is the first one was DIY BCA, but I think a few months before that, we worked with an arts, dance, music, and art collective, The People, from Oakland. And again, another independent group came in, Yak Films, amazing, amazing film crew that does dance films.
Is it coming?
They also generated work around this, because I wanted to show you just what this stuff looks like. Is that? All right. So I guess if I were just to answer the question around the static presentation model, I don't know if it addresses it directly, but I guess I would have to just comment on the nature of YBCA, which is, I'll go back to that same anchoring word, but my word is queer. And I want to use queer in the most open sense and not just around sexuality. But our mid-size, multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary nature makes us already kind of a strange animal. We're not just a presenting house. We're not just an exhibition space. We're not just a film program. And we don't even have education necessarily. We have community engagement. And this is the people who you'll see. Again, multimodal, amazing photographers. Mirror One was doing live painting. So, and just a few months before that, we had all of the folks from Mime Troupe who were in here. Totally other different crowd, right? And before that, we had the sisters who were in here and who brought lots of different kinds of audiences into the organization. So what I'm trying to get at is our very queerness has to do with the diversity even within our organization. We have a director that has an absolute love and passion and dedication to innovation and the new and the different. And I'll say this about Ken Foster. He was formerly a theater director, and I think that I can actually see also how he runs the organization, because the diversity he created in terms of the different kinds of curating and programming that happens results not only in diversity, but in a real dynamic, and it's dynamic, a dynamic environment where these very differences in the multifaceted nature of who we are has, I think, created multiple levels of entry into the organization, different uses of space over time, and I think a buzz that's kind of just grown organically, and that ranges, that buzz, whatever that is. But nevertheless, I think it's the collective, it's our collective strength and really our queerness that gives us kind of a unique, it's a unique element of who we are. And just the fact that I feel like I work with some of the most amazing professionals I've ever run into in the arts or otherwise helps. And the fact that we are so different. Like when I say dynamic, it's not like everybody just has, you know, great ideas and cool ideas. And this takes, you know, there's real fire that happens when something is kind of birthed or jettisoned out of us. So this is, these are some visual examples of this. And then maybe just the last one, if we wouldn't mind just starting to show that. I wanted to show this. This is the amazing stuff that happened with the people. And then just lastly, I just wanted to go back to our very, very first big idea night, which was on June 9th. Oh, we don't have time for that. I'll just stop there. Thank you so much. All right.
And as we transition to our last speaker, I just have to tell this story, which I told Joelle the other night, which is that I was standing on the corner in front of Yerba Buena Center for the Arts and overhearing some people behind me crossing the street, and one of them said to the other, "That's that really cool place. It's like a museum during the day and a club at night." And I just thought, oh my gosh, they're going to be so happy to hear that. So it's a great anecdote. And with that, let's end with some thoughts from Ron.
Thank you. I'll keep this pretty brief because I don't know about y'all, but I get fatigued when I sit and listen to people talk for too long. So I have three questions that I want to share with you all, which are questions that I find myself now as a person who's been in the grant-making field for a short 2 years, asking myself with increasing frequency. So hopefully this will provide maybe a little bit of a macro picture on how I think about the field. One, I think about who lives here. A lot. I'm obsessed with it. I can't get enough data about how the census information we're going to get in 2010 is really going to shift the way we see our community, not from an anecdotal perspective, but really giving us a sense of how things have changed with increasing rapidity over the last decade. But this is really something that's been happening for quite some time. And thinking especially about the fact that the arts and culture sector, as it is built and as these traditional venues, as we know them, was created in a time that looked very different, where, like, let's just say this community in the Bay Area was a very different community. So a few of the things that I'm obsessing about are the fact that the percentage of the population that is Asian and Latino is going to be even greater than it is now, in a majority, very, very soon, if not now, right? So what does that suggest about what we do here as people who are concerned with providing experiences in the arts for the communities that live here in the Bay Area? Very, very into that. Wealth gap, continuing to get bigger in the Bay Area, right? As well as everywhere else. What are the implications of that? I think these are things we should be very much concerned with and thinking about. The percentage of people under the age of 20 and over the age of 60 is increasing as a proportion of our population as well. Again, very different. I know, like, the sexy people right now that everyone wants to have in their audiences are, like, under 35, like 18 to 35 or something like that. But that's going to be an increasingly small proportion of the people who are actually here. So again, what does that suggest for us as we're thinking through when and how we do our work? And for me, what we're supporting at the foundation that I work at. And so the next question is, how do the people who live here actually want to engage with the arts? What do they want to do? I think it's an important question. Not just from a marketing perspective, but from a very substantive perspective. If we really care about giving people things that move them, that make them ask really deep, profound questions about their existential ideas. Like, if we are really concerned with that kind of relevancy, I think, again, we have to consider how people want to actually go about engaging with the art that we want to share with them as artists, as presenters, as administrators, as funders. So the great news is that we're increasingly learning about this. These are questions that funders are increasingly giving smart people money to go find out about. And I think there are also questions that people in the field are engaging in a more substantive and, I think, explicit way, in a more public way than they have before. So I'm sure many of you may be familiar with Alan Brown's work that a report he did for the Irvine Foundation about different modes of engagement and practices that are happening in the Central Valley and the Inland Empire. And, you know, whether or not you agree with analyses or summary findings, I think what's really interesting to observe is the fact that we increasingly have more information about the fact that people don't just want to sit and watch something happen. That there are a lot of other ways that people are engaged with creative practice as a very broad idea that wouldn't happen in a place that just had a proscenium stage and that would only happen from 8 to 10 p.m. on certain days of the week. So again, if what we care about is less, look at this great stuff I have, let me give it to you, which is one thing, and that's totally valid. But if we also care about who's here, how they're being engaged, and whether or not they feel like that's something that speaks to them, I think these are questions, again, that we have to really seriously consider as makers, as funders, as administrators. I think there's also the question of where things happen, which speaks to the point of the proscenium stage. And Maria Rosario Jackson, another researcher, again, I'm kind of a geek with data and reports and whatnot, has done a lot of work with her urban planning hat on, but particularly thinking about where arts and cultural experiences happen in communities. And this gets to my third question, which is a question that she proposed at a Grantmakers in the Arts panel that she spoke on last October in Chicago. And I was just like, oh, this is fascinating. So she brought up this idea of a cultural kitchen. And the metaphor being that if you go to a potluck where you share a dish with someone, you have to have a kitchen in which to make that dish that you bring to the potluck. And that kitchen is a place for experimentation. It's a place for collaboration. It's a place for taste testing. It's a place to figure out what it is you want to share. And so the metaphor then was, if the cultural commons is a place that we really care about, say in an urban context, since we're in San Francisco for right now, where are the cultural kitchens in our communities? Who's being supported to experiment, to create, to taste things, to come in and out, and to have those open kitchens where art is getting created, where ideas are being generated? And then when it comes to the commons, who's setting the table? What shape is it? I like the shape. I threw that one in there. Who gets invited to participate, right? And in what context is that happening? So this gets to the other question, but I'm kind of interested in the prequel, which is, where is stuff getting made? So I throw these as open questions, again, to folks in the audience, because I'd be really interested to know, with, again, my funder hat on, like, what are the cultural kitchens that you see? Because I think a lot of this activity is very invisible to someone like me who sits and tries to figure out where to make grants, because this isn't all happening under a 501c3 structure. So the last question then is, how would I, as a funder, how would we, as people who care and have resources to share, go about supporting this work? How would we get grants to people performing drag in the nightlife? How do we ensure that work doesn't have to be decontextualized in order to give it validity or to support it with resources? And then the question that I ask, too, is, how would giving resources potentially distort or change the dynamics in what is happening in communities? Because I think that's a very important thing to consider. So I will leave all of those big, fun questions out there hanging, and I think we can all jump in or just sit and think, whatever feels good. Thanks.
Thank you. Wow, that was a lot to take in. And I think that I had some questions prepared, but I feel like also the panelists have posed some interesting questions. And I happen to know, because I invited you, that there are some very smart people in the audience as well. So would anyone like to, is it okay, Mary, if we just
go for it? Go for it.
Does anyone want to jump in there and either answer one of the questions that Ron or one of the other panelists has posed, or ask a question of your own?
There's a microphone waiting for you. In fact,
right
there are
here,
three.
Yeah.
There's even
we
an
have
extra one.
Four, yeah.
Ron, I was really inspired by one of the questions. Sure. I was really inspired by one of the questions that you asked, and have been thinking about one of these questions in a different sort of term. And this issue of, as a grant writer, how can you create grants or opportunities for folk settings, a drag setting, a bomba setting, the work that's going on in underground communities. I'm a part of the electronic music community. So how can we support those things? How do we access them? And then, as somebody who is committed and working in those communities, but also committed to providing those things in an atmosphere where it's going to have a greater impact, like a theater. So I've been thinking about the complications of those two things. So I am committed to having money and resources and presenting in venues that build prestige and create accessibility and have my work be seen by more people. So in order to do that right now in this current model, I have to write a lot. Yet, as a movement-based artist, what excites me is finding new and unusual and articulate ways of moving and interacting with music. That takes time in the laboratory. It also takes time, because I am a folk artist, drawing inspiration from electronic music and just spending time dancing in a community of 200, 300 people. I have to spend time there too. Yet, here I am writing and writing and writing because I need money, because I want other people to say, yes, she's doing a good thing, go look at her work. I'm writing so much that I feel that sometimes I'm spending more time writing than actually in the laboratory. And so I wanted to just present that as an issue, I think, that's presented by this current model. Yes, we do want resources, because then we can have a greater impact. And, you know, how do we deal with learning this other language that we have to learn in order to get those resources and still maintain our own practice. So I don't know. Maybe I just raised another meaty topic.
Yeah. Does anyone on the panel want to speak to that?
I would just say a few things. Thank you for sharing your questions. One is, you kind of mentioned in speaking the idea that certain venues give legitimacy that could, I will impute, lead to funding potentially. I think part of our work as funders is to deconstruct our own ideas about what is legitimate and what deserves funding and deserves support. And I think we have some really wonderful organizations that help us climb that learning curve, like Dancers Group and like the Theater Bay Area Cash Program, for example, which is a fairly kind of quick turnaround small grants program for artists who want to create that doesn't have a lot of the barriers that we as funders are often well known for setting up. We have organizations like Lily's organization, ACTA, the Alliance for California Traditional Arts, that is supporting work in communities, supporting folk work and traditional art. So I think that increasingly there are intermediary organizations, as we often call them, that have this kind of expertise to not decontextualize work and to be able to meet people where they are and to not have people flying off into writing in languages that don't make sense to them when they should be moving. But I think it's also incumbent on us still, as people who sit in the ivory towers that we inhabit, to deconstruct our ideas as well, such that that learning trickles up, for better or worse. Mm-hmm. That's the direction, I think, in many respects. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing. And Jessica posed a little question to me over email, and then I'll toss it to the panelists.
Yeah, I was about to toss that question at you.
do you want to state the question, because I don't have it written down?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of my prepared questions for Ron was just saying, you know, if you were to develop a radical new initiative that would decentralize artistic support to infuse these non-traditional venues and projects with funding, what would that look like?
My answer is I don't know, but something that I think is really interesting. I can't remember the name of the site, but there's a website that teachers can go to and apply for quick turnaround grants for classroom materials. They don't even have to fill out a grant application. You say, I need this much money. Yes, right? And it's up to like $500, or it's not a very large amount, right? Right?
Philanthropic Ventures Foundation, just to get that on the record.
Thank you. I'm really bad with names and things. So I think that's a great idea, personally. I don't know. We'd have to think about, you know, what's the amount that would make the most sense to actually be useful. But it would be great to just be able to apply every so often to a revolving fund where you just say, I need $1,000 to do this thing. Wonderful, right? And we have some of those kinds of things, Creative Capacity Fund, and folks can mention them, that are fairly quick turnaround. But this idea of not having to write anything, really, just I send something in, I get the money. That would be really great, right?
That'd be great.
So I think we can also, as funders, to be more creative in thinking about other mechanisms for investment. So there's not a Kickstarter that gets born every day, but I didn't see a lot of grantmakers really jumping on the wagon to support that vehicle, which has now led to a lot of projects and individual artists being able to fundraise for themselves outside of a grant writing system and structure. So I think there are also ways in which we could be thinking much more broadly about ways we can support artists that aren't direct grants, even though I know that is very important, but that can create other opportunities that are often generated that we wouldn't come up with ourselves. Mm-hmm. So other folks want to jump on that? Get to dream a little?
I have a question more about the presenting model and how we're able to unravel not only audience expectations of when something is going to happen and how it's going to happen, but also how we unravel artists' expectations. And, you know, so for so long, artists have kind of, well, I'm not going to say all artists, but certain artists that I've come across have kind of seen, oh, I need to have something that looks like a season, and then I really have, like, made it, or then I'm really legitimate. So that's one part, and I think the other part of it for me is I would like to hear examples from anyone in the room, successful presentations where there's been like an increase in visibility, as well as kind of multiple streams of revenue. So not just a foundational grant. When you have a free performance, it's free. You know, you don't have people giving. So I was just, those are the two things that I was interested in.
Well, is there somebody in the audience who wants to respond to that? I know we're all kind of doing the same work. So there's this group up here, but I know everybody is pulling work together here in this room. I think that one thing when I was at the foundation that we kind of tried to encourage people and support really is this idea of like building your individual donor base. And how do artists do that? Like, because if we pass around a hat, we'll get some money. Like, we'll get money. You'll get, you know, you could probably get, you know, $50 tonight, you know, for your work. But so I think it's just about kind of building that confidence and having those conversations with each other about like, well, your work, I guess you know as an individual that your work is worth that much, but then like, how is it that you show up to do that and ask for that money because and allow yourself to do that. That's one thing that my group is kind of grappling with, because we had a fundraiser this one day at this in the back of some Mexican restaurant on 24th Street in this like patio that's not used often, Casa Sanchez. They're great. And we walked away with $1,700, like, because we let people know what we were doing. Like, they were like, you know, we're really like not trying to go on a fancy vacation. Like, we're trying to record a CD, or which is a revenue builder, right? And so how can we let people know so that they have something tangible to latch onto? And then how, as administrators, not only artists, but administrators, do, because that's what you are. As an artist, you're an administrator to a certain degree, unless you have some luxury of having a nice wife or husband or somebody who loves you who's going to, like, do that for you, which some people have, God bless them, but a lot of us don't, you know? And so we have to be the administrator and the artist. So how do you capture those names, engage those people through an act like a small institution? And I think that one thing it's sometimes challenging to find the institution that fits your work as well to present your work. And I think that's a question I have about, you know, what kind of venues do we need for electronica music or for whatever work you're doing, and how do we engage with builders, community development people, or with funders or fellow artists to create those spaces? We just lost one recently, right? Mama Calizo's. And so what do we need to do to recreate that?
I also just want to hit that from a presenter standpoint. In the presenting community, I feel like there's this sort of idea that non-traditional performance venues and these alternative events are great, but really the value is that they're going to get people to want to pay to come and see a show at 8 o'clock on a Friday or Saturday night. So the value then keeps coming back to this traditional practice that we've identified that is revenue generating, right? And the other practices are used to feed that practice. And I think that's something that I'd really like to explode. But you're right, you know, to put on a free event, you need some other source of income, and then we're looking towards funders to provide that. And I think, you know, how can we get creative outside of those two models?
Hello. So I'm Yann Sadoniu, and I do run a space named Kunst of Arts, a space that it's 1 year old. It used to be actually on Fifth and Market. It was one corridor, one room, and it was very easy to manage. And then because of some structural problems, we moved on a venue that is actually double the size. And I'm coming to this point where I'm thinking, okay, what do I do with the space? How can I bring people in? How can I share that with, first of all, with my colleagues, and as well to bring in people to experience what kind of work we've been creating? So the turnaround was very fast, so I didn't even have time to approach any funders. So I just looked around for people like myself, see who has similar needs. So a group of people came. It's like, okay, I want to be there. I want to support it. It's cool. Let's do that. So one space is a basement. The other one is a wonderful 2,500 square foot with three sides of windows and all that stuff. So how do I make the funding? How do I, you know, make the space work? It's by talking to people that have similar needs, because again, I didn't have the time to go. By the time my founder gets the conversation and say, yes, let me look, maybe the next round, I didn't have the time to wait for that. So I had 4 days to just do that shift. So I think it's a tremendous need in the community to trust yourself and bring a product that people can actually understand and use and utilize. I think it's one way of producing as well revenue. The other point that I wanted to make is when you have a space and you know you have these events, you're like, okay, well, 4th of July, this and this and that. I was just like, you know what? Let's have an event the 4th of July. Let's have an event the Valentine's Day. And actually, those events have been very successful. And I don't want to feel as a dancer or as a creator, as an artist, that I'm secondary to the Oscars. So actually, I have an event the Oscar night. Even if I have less people, at least I know I can put myself, I feel that I'm strong and equally to what my beliefs are, you know, to go against the Oscar night. And I would say for all of us, you know, if we're going to really go, what is available is very little, very, very little. It's a huge competition. The theater used to be the space where people would go. Now, you know, it's the TV, it's this and that, drag shows, you know, it's a competition already here. You know, so how do we believe of what we do? How do we present that? How do we use the prime time to do it? And also being alternative and being smart and doing, you know, Monday morning, because you never know. Some people, you know, if you're in Berlin, Monday mornings, a lot of people that are, you know, free. Yeah. So anyway, those are 2 points.
Thank you.
to the issue of how do you generate funds or revenues, right? Outside of what we know, foundation or revenue. You know, I don't know necessarily the answer to that because I think we're at a turn socially, economically. I mean, we've heard that, but we all feel that we're at a turn. And I think more and more the way, when I think about our organization, I think about, we talk a lot about, we just went through this whole strategic redirection. And one of the things that we talked about, I mean, a lot is innovation, but what became more apparent, I mean, and of course, like how do you navigate a course through unpredictable times? I think getting that view of where we're at, I mean, I think it was more evident to see that we do have our very diversity has created also diverse forms of income so that if you were to just look at our portfolio, I think and believe me, we're feeling it too, but I think in general, there's something there. There's something about like the diversity of ways you can get incomes. And then I also think with the Big Idea Night, you know, I engineered that and I had to really draw from my experience in the 80s and 90s as a club promoter. And that's one model that actually works and supports itself or presents art, and especially here in probably New York at a certain time, LA at certain times, art was happening at these spaces. I mean, I used to go to, you know, clubs, James St. James. I mean, it would be like the kind of thing that's happening at something where it's an event, it's a happening. It's, you know, you're just going to go there and take a chance. So I think the two things that we're looking at right now very seriously, not only as an organization, but as a society overall, is that cash, you know, cash is still cash, but participation now in our culture has become a huge thing. You do the free to get the participation. Now what do you do with all that participation? For Big ID Nights, you get more participation, and you do it over time, right? And we haven't found the answer. Then I thought, okay, well, all right, if you're letting them in free, you slip into club mentality, you're letting folks in free, well, hopefully you'll make some money from the drinks. That's not proving to be true either. You know what I mean? But then there's other mechanisms. Then you have to look further. Like, why isn't that happening? You know, we have an amazing union that runs our basically it runs our theaters and our performance spaces. within our own organization, we have economies we have to deal with, like realities we have to deal with alone. And so a big idea night costs a lot of money to put on, right? And when, you know, and that foundation funding's gone away. So it's one of those things where I don't know if there's an answer, but there's something about cash and now participation. What do you do with that participation? And there's evidence all around us. People who are paying Farmville real money for like virtual or not material assets. It's connected to what we're doing because it's telling us how people are collectively behaving and what our values are and what the potential of that participation is. So I think right now when we don't have answers, I think maybe we can do what artists do best, and that's to deeply observe. There's an organization in St. Louis that I'm dying to visit, and I just did a panel with them where they've taken art and creativity and created a program for new and emerging businesses to go the artist's way. LLCs, this organization has created a program for LLCs to get into artistic thinking about how to design their LLCs and how to solve their problems. And what's amazing about that, I mean, of course, we say, oh my God, that has to do with business, that has nothing to do with what we do, there's human values, et cetera. At the end of the day, what they've proven is that creativity or the tools that we use, the things that come to us into as both intuition, as art and science, can be used in other ways. You know, another brilliant example of that is visual thinking strategies. Do you guys know VTS? Which is a classic art education thing that, you know, it's about deeply like spending time with work and just asking basic questions about it. Jessica and I were talking about what do you see, what more do you see, and what makes you say that? You know, in this process, it's been very successful in K-12, but they moved it outside of the arts, and they're finding that it's working for medical students who are doing far better by deeply observing the things they're doing. And wouldn't you, I mean, isn't it thrilling that there are future generations of doctors who are better observers, right? So I'm thinking about what other elements in the arts, in our art making, the science in the work that we do that's applicable. And more than anything, it's not just a cheap shot at like making money at a desperate time, but really, how is arts moving into the humanities? How is arts evolving outside of its specialized spaces and its categories where we're talking about legitimacy and everything else? Because we already know that artists and societies moved on, but it is the very tools and it's the very spaces, and even us in the industry who are having a harder time, like, you know, moving along with it. So I think the more limber and the more quick we are to be able to do that, I think the more interesting it'll get.
Wow, that's a lot to think about. Yeah. Do you want to pass the microphone down there? And then, oh, yes, thank you.
Okay, hi. I suppose what I was thinking about earlier, which then goes along with what you just said, has something to do with what you were saying with the insularness of the community. But I was thinking that the conversation is flowing a lot around funding, which of course is a very strong part of legitimacy, right? But what I was just wondering what our culture has to do with all of this, and thinking about the cultural perspective of legitimacy, and you know, because it's not just about the money that you get when you know you get presented at YBCA, for example. It's also about your peers and the wider culture around you seeing YBCA as an important institution or as a, you know, big building or as something that they recognize. And so I was thinking about our culture as this arts community and as the wider sort of like big American culture, which led me to think about lots of other things. But I was wondering, beyond funding, what the way that while we are here talking about other ways of presenting and showing our work and developing audiences and all of that, the ways in which we are also implicated in our actions and in the tickets that we buy and all of that, how we are implicating ourselves in the cyclical pattern of the presenting model that we're in.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Talk a little bit about the static part that you brought up. Last week I spoke with a gentleman. He's on a couple of board of directors, nonprofits back east. He was telling me that for the last 8 years, there's been a dual study being done, one by Stanford. The attendance for the arts has been going down for at least a good 10 years in all, you know, the visual arts, performing arts. The one on the bottom is dance, and the one that's going down the least is Broadway musicals. Broadway musicals are a great example of sitting there watching, even more so than visiting a museum, because at least in a museum you're walking around and doing something, but with the Broadway plays, you're just sitting there. So it's interesting to me that that's the one that's going down the slowest. And with those Broadway musicals, because I'm involved a little bit with San Francisco and San Jose, Saturday night and Thursday night are the two most popular nights. That those are the ones that Thursday sells out first for the week, Saturday night for the weekends. So to me, I hope we keep some of our static, because what I see is I see most of our weekend performances Friday and Saturday. And then next after that is maybe Saturday and Sunday, and then maybe Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Thursday night is the least of what I see going on every weekend. So it is nice when there are some Thursdays. Also, I'd like to see maybe some more afternoon performances. I've had a number of choreographers just this year alone, and we're barely at 2 months, who have told me either through email or talking, saying, gosh, I'm so bummed out I'm not going to see David Herrera because I'm performing that weekend, or I can't go to La Meridian because I'm working that that weekend. So I've heard that many times just in the last 2 months. So I'm hoping we can spread that Friday and Saturday out a little bit more, just so people can get in there. And the other thing is I do see some groups getting a little bit past. Liz Fain did a great piece at Theater Artaud, where they turned the theater into galleries and people walked through it. They then took it to the Marin Library. Very successful. My feeling is I haven't had a chance to talk to her yet, but it sounded like they were able to get good funding through help through the library to put that on. And they hope to take it to more libraries. And it's at libraries because it's as most of you know, her dance has come from literature. And then this Saturday, I think her name is Christine Germain, is going to do dance at the Oakland Public Library, free event. And that was quite a struggle for her to do that. Most libraries wouldn't let her even practice there. She had to start off in bookstores, I think. So they finally got it set up. So I do see, and I think that's nice, because a couple of dancers have told me that because they're performing, they may now be able to get over there because this is something that's going on during the daytime and doesn't interfere. So I hope we get to keep some of this static model simply because I love it. But I also think we can expand it out more. Also, the gentleman was explaining to me about, I told him how wonderful the local dance community is in San Francisco. I discovered it 2 years ago, standing out in line here, where the first time I was here, the young lady in front of me turned around and said, well, who are you coming to see? Who's performing that you know? And I said, well, nobody. I'm just coming to see. And she said, well, thank you, you're our audience, because most of our audience are families, friends, fellow performers. And I still hear that. One of the ladies who runs the Dance Mission Theater was telling me a couple weeks ago, we really depend on a lot of dancers in our performances because we rely on them to fill the audience. And this friend of mine was explaining to me that social capital. It's like a community who come together and build a community garden, a huge one. Same thing with the local dancing here. It's real social capital. I think that's a wonderful thing, and it's something I'm going to look more into, because he explained that although it's rich here, one of the places that has the least amount of social capital is the peninsula, the home of Silicon Valley, high tech. So I think that's very interesting that that is a real challenge down there. So I love local dance, so keep up some of that static.
Thank you. We're going to Joe over here next.
Sorry. So I'm Joe Landini. I run a 49-seat theater here in SoMa that specializes in residency programs. And I think one of the things that I'm noticing is that we're framing this as an either-or kind of conversation. And what I want to encourage people to think is that you've got two models, and I think they complement each other. One of the nice things about static programming is it's very pragmatic. It allows you to project into the future for your finances and things like that, which is why we're sort of roped into it to a large degree. But this last year, we started experimenting with non-traditional programming, and we helped found a community festival. And what I found was that ended up complementing our established programming because it increased our visibility. And so I just want to encourage people to think of it in terms of two models that actually can complement each other.
Great. In the back.
My microphone here. Hi, my name's Beth Fine, and I came because this is exactly what I think is important. And I think static, I go to lots of dance performances and theaters and Counterpulse and all kinds of places, and I love that, and I think it's great. But about 7-8 years ago, coming home from one with some friends, we were just talking about how much time you put in as an artist and a dancer, you know, working on your choreography, taking class, all kinds of things, and then how little time there is in the performance and how important that dance practice is art. And I came up with this idea where I thought, what if we all just got up and danced and didn't wait for the theater opportunity? And I would say to dancers who are looking for a place to perform, that that's an idea you can take any place. It's called Dance Anywhere. It's like in 3 weeks. I do it once a year. And everybody in the world is invited to get up and dance at the same time. It's on a Friday at noon if you're in San Francisco. But if you're in Paris, it's 8. And we had it in 27 countries last year. And I think that, so I'd encourage you to do that and take that idea and go with it somewhere. You know, do it with us on March 18th, or do it yourself. Decide you're going to perform outside on the street or in a public plaza or whatever. I mean, what we do, we're very underfunded, so I can't address that part of it. A lot of it's volunteer. What we try to do is we promote anybody who does it and gives us a video. We'll edit their video for them. We put their photos up. We try to get press and that kind of thing. And I was going to also mention that what Mary did, and she got great press, and it was a fabulous performance, and I've seen her perform here and other places. She did it in her studio. She did it in the building she's in every day and used that space as an alternative. So I think one of the reasons I came tonight is I think that as artists, we have to make it happen. You can't wait for the opportunity for a theater or even to get a residency somewhere. That as long as you're an artist and going to keep growing, you're creative. Come up with something.
Thank you. Going to the front row.
I just was waiting to hear that all night, Beth. Thank you for that. Boy, it's a beleaguered room, isn't it? Part of what I want to say is venues don't legitimize artists. Artists legitimize venues. Can we all have a round of applause for that, please? Artists legitimize venues. Let's shift the paradigm here. I'm hearing so much about the presenting model, the presenter, the static, the this, and everything is about engagement. And all these things are awesome, and everyone who spoke tonight is so on point. But what I hear also is this angst, also, and a lot of pain, and a lot of rejection, and a lot of frustration, and a lot of repression. And also there are these profound moments of celebration and success in terms of group action. And all these things are part of our daily lives. It's part of what we do. But I really want to get clear on this. If the reason that an artist wants to be in a venue is because the other artists who were there were great, and they want to be in that crowd. They want to be legitimized by their practice in their form. And a venue which has stood long enough to withstand the onslaught of years and years and years of surviving, you know, one of which I run, you know, is that's a real thing. And yes, we think very carefully about what those relationships are. But the reality of it is that it wouldn't be there. It wouldn't be there without the artist. So if anything, I think the paradigm needs to shift profoundly. And, you know, in my work, I work site, I work in-house, I work regionally. My theater presents in, right now in California, in 5 cities, not just in San Francisco. I present in 4 cities around the country. If an artist in my residency comes to me and says, I don't want to be in your theater, screw you, I want to be out in the field and I need this, I'm going to figure out how to do it. So I think it does boil down to who's in charge. And I think who's in charge is the creative process. Who's in charge is the vitality, the necessity of getting these messages out. That's who's in charge. And if we're not in our field servicing that, we're in really going the wrong direction. So I think that's huge. I'd like to see, you know, I love, you know, Mary's most recent success too, because it really was about, you know, I've presented Mary before. I've worked with her before. She's been in many theaters around town. You know what? She did something in her living room, essentially. And all of a sudden, that, you know, the primacy and clarity of that vision hit. And that was it was a huge success for you. And I think that's a message to carry forward. It's like, well, who are you waiting to legitimize you for the love of God? Who are you waiting for? You know, if you're waiting for me, there's a long list, and I've only got, you know, 48 operating weeks. So how many people are in this room? I can't service everyone in this room in a year, let alone 5. So where does that come from? When you take it to the funding question, I think one thing I would like to put out there, since there are funders in the room and we are all part of a funding community, whether you're a funder or not, you're part of a funding community. Again, funding communities can't exist without communities to fund. You are a stakeholder if you're part of that community, and your voice is absolutely welcome at the table. And finding ways to put it there is about you acting with agency on your own behalf. It is not just about, I got it, I didn't get it, they like me, they don't like me. You can always pick up the phone. You know, I'm not allowed to not return an email, you know, let alone a funder. So, you know, where are your priorities and how might I have a conversation with you is something that I think we're all afraid to do. I know I was afraid to do it when I went into this field, but you have to. So part of it is saying, well, you know, what I think is really missing in the field is that we're funding presenters to choose artists, which is backward. We should be funding artists to articulate themselves so that they're useful to presenters, you know? So there's a major model shift there. And I see a lot of our community beginning to operate in this way and think that way. But it's a long-term haul, and it's not gonna happen if we come from this perspective of, well, it's legitimized by statistics, it's legitimized by, you know, success with a large response, what have you. So I think, and I do feel those rubrics changing. And I think Hewlett, for example, is one of the real leaders in making us all think about that. They really have funded a lot of research, as has Irvine, to make sure that we're looking at what's really happening in our communities. So I think that's going on. But, you know, I love your word, trickle up. I love that phrase. It was fantastic because it really made me feel like you're instigating in a beautiful way. And I think that's what we all need to think about. So, you know, when I look at this, I try to take at a view of it where I understand, like all of you, I'm a working artist in a leadership position in our community. But my take on the whole thing is you've got to figure out where you're located in yourself, and you've got to know where your vision is, and you've got to know who you want to be. And garnering that support is going to happen much more naturally if you're not fighting upstream against a frame that has nothing to do with you or how you're legitimized in your work. You've got to take that on yourself, and that agency will come to you like that once it's flowing in your veins and you're speaking your truth. So I encourage us all to think that way and maybe turn this around a little bit.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you so much for what you said. I really appreciate it as a working artist. I wanted to say one thing and then also present a question to the artists in the room. I present an event called Makeup Mutiny, and I curate it. My intention is to have a very diverse bill of movement-based art, and then it morphs into a dance party. And the goal is really to present work that anybody from the street is going to go, so that anybody's going to, you know, someone's going to come and they're going to see something they like, so that it's not always just, you know, dance theater or just modern dance or just hip hop. But really the main purpose of the evening is that we're able to come together as a diverse audience, different education levels, sort of socioeconomic backgrounds, and enjoy each other and hang out and talk to each other. I get so bored as a dancer choreographer, writing, taking class, like I want community. And so that's the point of it, right? It's really about community building, getting to talk to other people, getting to party with other people, play with other people, enjoy other people. And so, you know, as an artist, I find myself chasing something, which I think you sort of pointed to. And then there's the satisfaction I get out of making a fulfilled piece of art, learning something, or taking a chance and seeing how that goes. But what I'm curious about is, if we're saying there's a problem with the current model, you know, I'm curious about what people are going for. Are people interested in money? Are people interested in other people validating them? Are people interested in being inspired by other people's work? Is it about community? Like, what are we actually going for? If we're saying there's a problem, what's really the goal for people in the room who are working artists?
But let's see. I think that might be a really great way to segue into the next iteration of this, which is, I think, this evening for me has just, you know, managed to problematize proscenium and 8 p.m. on the weekend and, you know, who is trapped, I think is getting to be an interesting question by this model. And Sam's question of, you know, well, what the hell are we actually trying to do here? What do we want from this activity that we all think that we need to do so much? So my suggestion is, can we take these questions and move into the wine and silly snacks part of it and talk amongst ourselves in a more easy way? And thank you very much for being here, and please stay.
Yeah, so thank you all. Sorry, Patrick. Just one moment before we all break up, which is that this conversation has really just started. So I encourage you to continue it over drinks, but I also encourage you to continue it online. So we have people who are going to be, our intern Grace is going to be blogging about this on the CounterPulse website. And I really hope that you will go to the CounterPulse website and add your own comments and suggestions. You can listen to this, you can share the link of this conversation, but most importantly, you can share your voice. So I encourage you to continue the conversation online and also approach us. We are thinking about what future dance discourse topics should be, and we're open to your ideas. So thank you.